let's just breeze in and welcome for a more intimate adult gathering, a sort of adults-only gathering. I'm delighted, or truly am delighted, to be able to welcome David here. And he, ever since I first read him, he sort of leapt into my pantheon of writers I really most admire. And what we're going to do today is I'll start off talking for, it's half an hour or so, just questions and answers, and then open it out. So we'll just become more like a conversation, hopefully, after that. So people that know David's work or want to say anything will just breeze in at that point. So my opening question is starting with a Skelly question, but it's also linked in with Counting Stars. So that early question really is, can this be seen as an autobiography, or is that cheating to read it like that?
It was the first time I learned how to accommodate my own autobiography into fiction.
Right.
And those stories were really crucial to me. They were really important to me. I wrote them before Skellig. That was the book I wrote before Skellig.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I hadn't realised that.
Yeah. And it was published, I think, 3 books afterwards. But and inside there's a story called Where Your Wings Were. Mm-hmm. And that story I wrote about 10 years before Skellig, in a little room. And it's about a boy who, his sister's died, and he goes to heaven and sees his sister in heaven and then comes back home again. And I wrote this story and I thought, oh God, I can't write that. So I put it in a drawer and forgot about
it.
And then after various kind of adventures with different forms of fiction and different forms of rejection, I took that story out of the drawer and bang, it just kind of produced this whole new book. And it was a way of allowing myself to be like a northern writer, which I'd always kind of fought against. It was a way of allowing myself to be influenced by Catholicism. Mm-hmm. It was a way of allowing myself to deal with things that in my life were really major, but kind of in terms of the world were insignificant. Mm-hmm. And it was, as soon as I began to write those stories, it was really interesting that, the thing about the paradox about the local being the universal. These stories began to get sort of taken by magazines I've been trying to get into for years. And they were broadcast on Radio 4 and sort of... And I wrote those stories and changed everything. And when I finished them, I was literally walking along the street and I put them into a postbox to send off to my agent to see if I could get them published. I was walking along the street and Skellig just started to tell itself in my mind.
Once this was all done, right?
Yes, this was all finished.
Because I was surprised... I was struck by how many themes of Skellig were here. And there's the mother. Is it fair to see that mother is your mother with the arthritis?
Yes, absolutely.
Those links are there.
Yeah.
There is the death of a sister. Mm. And we have this sort of threatened death of the sister. There's even the heartbeats of God and the feeling of the heartbeat.
Aye.
So I was wondering whether there is... an almost willfully unanalyzed element of sort of mythic elements of your life that's set into Skellig.
When I wrote Counting Stars, the word myth I think was really important. I was aware of kind of almost developing a private mythology. Mm-hmm. That was, and I think in many ways all writers need a kind of personal mythology to give them kind of context and to give them a sense of who they are, apart from just a kind of psychological who they are. But you need a kind of almost like a private mythology. And when I was writing Counting Stars, it was a mythology to do with my sisters and my brother, mum, my dad, and about, having lost a sister and Catholicism. And it was like taking all those true elements of my life and kind of restructuring them. So they became a kind of mythology.
Right.
And ever since I wrote Counting Stars, that has just kept going on and on. I'm still writing that book. I'm still writing a long-term project, which is short stories that grew out of my childhood in Felling. Yeah.
I was interested that elsewhere in your fiction, I'd never have guessed at the Catholic background. Mm. But that Catholic background is really strong in here. Mm. And there's you talk about Catholicism as a worn-out religion. I wondered if you didn't really feature Catholicism, am I right, in your other novels, because you're looking to universalize things a little bit more, not just be critical of Catholicism.
Yeah, it was... if you're brought up as a Catholic, I was brought up as a Catholic, and it wasn't a kind of really dark, horrible Catholicism, but it was Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And Catholicism is kind of, it's bred into your bones. If you're brought up as a Catholic boy, it's there in your bones, you can't get rid of it. But you spend your life trying to get it out, and fighting against it. And And I got to a certain age, and I just thought, oh, God, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. Mm-hmm. So it was like just sighing and saying, oh, I'll just let it come in. And that's what produced Counting Stars, mm-hmm. you know. So I was able to talk about priests and talk about the sacraments and saints and kind of, you know, Catholic imagery. And it came like a gift, actually. Mm-hmm. It was like, because Catholicism is filled with extraordinary stuff, you know, amazing imagery, amazing yeah. ritual, fantastic language, extraordinary characters. And so it was like taking those useful elements of Catholicism, kind of forgetting the angst, mm-hmm. and kind of developing right, from okay. there. Right. And then after that, it was like, you know, as I said, mythology. So it became, so in the other books, it's not kind of named, but I think it grows from, it's almost like trying to find artistic equivalents to Catholicism mm-hmm. in some ways.
In the story, Jack Law. Mm. Jack Law, could you say something about the character of Jack Law?
Jack Law is based on a tramp. We lived in a town called Felling, which is on a steep hill, and at the top of the hill there was some heather hills where we used to play. And there was a tramp who lived there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to us as growing children, he was quite an exotic character and actually quite a nice guy. And, mm-hmm. And there was all this, there was mythology about him, that he was actually sent money by his sister who lived in Canada. But he lived in the grass, you know, he lived in the in a kind of cave at the top of the hill. And he used to go to Dragoni's coffee shop, where we all went with our grandmothers and with our mothers, and then as teenagers, where we went and sort of drank coffee and smoked. And often the tramp would be there mm-hmm. as well, and he was just very silent, this very exotic character, sipping his Horlicks, and then he would just disappear. And then years later, when I was writing Counting Stars, and the character of the tramp just came back again, and I kind of constructed the story around the tramp about, and he became a tramp because he was brought in, he went to the same school as me in this story. He was asked questions about the catechism, and if anybody's been a Catholic, you know, getting asked questions about the catechism is kind of terrifying. It was at the time, because I remember the head teacher coming in, she said, and it should go around the class, who made you, why did God make you, you know, mm-hmm. what are the seven glorious mysteries, blah, blah, blah. And if you didn't know the answer, she used to take you to the front of the class and you'd get the strap mm-hmm. for not knowing the answer. And I thought, and I've constructed this story about that had happened to the tramp, but he had been sent out because he didn't know the answer. He'd been sent out into the freezing cold, and he had to run around the playground mm-hmm. in the snow and the frost and the ice. And mm-hmm. when he came back in again, he was dumb. He was struck dumb by that.
And there's a line you use in the book just after that. The children are seeing all of this happening and thinking mm-hmm. something is wrong. And there's a line, the things we knew were wrong were all mixed up with the things we were told were right. I wonder if that's part of your mission of your writing, to help folk and kids especially sift institutional lies from their own truths.
I think so. I think it is. And it's not like I have a purpose, but I think, you know, fiction is in the end, it's packs of lies, and all these books are lies, but it's also a way of telling truth. And as a fiction writer, you have to kind of somehow accommodate truth within the lies of fiction. Mm. And I think we have to do that in life. And writing about Catholicism was really interesting in that sense, you know, because we were told all these things were true. So you believe they're true when you're six. But then when you're 36 and you start to doubt them, yeah. it's still a problem to actually pull them apart and say, oh, that's true, that's not true. Yeah. So, yeah, fiction can help kids, help everybody to tell the truth from the delusion.
I was struck as well. You mentioned in one of the stories the book The Third Eye by T. Lobsang Rampa. Yeah. I bought the book, and I was really disturbed when I learned that this story might not be true and that the guy might never have left Ireland.
Yeah.
Well, I was told Liverpool, in fact, but that's another story.
I was told Essex.
And so in The Subtle Body, someone lets you know that this character might be a fake. Well, lets the narrator know. Mm. And the narrator says, he's asked, he's the real thing to you, and the answer there is yes. And I'm touched by that faith in storytelling and the willingness to find the real thing in fact or fiction, not necessarily needing to distinguish.
I think so, and I think that's one of the things that I've kind of explored is the truth of fiction. In fact, the book I've just finished, it's all about that. And I had a strip of paper, I stick things all over my cabinet when I'm writing, and I had a strip of paper above my head when I was writing the last book, and it was from I can't remember, Native American chief from the 19th century. And his statement was, he said, of course not all these things happened, but when you think about them, they've got to be true, haven't they?
Right.
And I think that's, you know, it's like, that's what fiction is, you know, it's like packs of lies, and you think, well, of course it didn't happen. In fact, that I was going to put that at the beginning of Counting Stars, I was going to put, not all these things happened, but everything is true.
Right.
So I think beneath the kind of apparent truth of occurrence, beneath it there can be a truth of, you know, emotion or spirit, which runs underneath everything. Because all our stories and all our fiction are fiction, but beneath them there is a kind of truth that holds us together.
And I keep quoting you at the moment, lines from your book as though they're true. A teacher, Miss Lynch, says to the narrator, "When you travel through the place in which you were born, you travel through yourself."
Mm.
And place for me is vital for a writer, but the world of Felling becomes mythical in your work. Mm. But I've long sensed that writers need to be displaced in order to do that. But you're still rooted very much in your community. I wondered if you had that process of being displaced that triggered writing for you at all.
I did. And while I spent most of my life, apart from university and then another stretch of time in a commune in East Anglia, most of my life has been spent in the northeast. Mm-hmm. But kind of imaginatively, I haven't. I spent most of my kind of 20s and 30s not being there. So I was kind of somewhere else. You know, I was like with Marquez in South America, or Borges, or with Flannery O'Connor in the Southern States, sort of imaginatively that I was there and refusing to acknowledge that. And then when I became 40, and I looked back to where I'd come from, and I looked back to a Catholic childhood in Felling in the 50s and 60s, and I thought, well, actually, it looked as exotic as Marquez. So I took the facts, which to some people seem really exotic, about stories about angels, you know, and the threat of hell and all these kinds of things, and people being transformed and people being almost in a state of hypnotic trance. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if Marquez was writing about these, would think that's just amazing how exotic. Mm-hmm. But these things happened in Felling.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like looking back, going away and then looking back allowed me to see the kind of richness of it all.
Right.
And that was my displacement, really. And once I discovered that, it allowed me to kind of go deeper and deeper and deeper. And a lot of writers do that. You know, I was reading Roddy Doyle recently, and Roddy Doyle said, well, of course, in this part of Dublin, everything happens. You know? And it's true, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Everything, all tragedies happen in any small area. So I suppose that's what I've been doing. And, you know, sometimes I go through periods of just hating myself where I think, what the hell am I doing? Mm. But I'm kind of driven to do it. There's nothing I can do.
How did you maintain that faith in yourself as a writer up to the 40s when you got this sense?
I had about seven people who thought I was really good. And it was like that. I mean, so I ran literary magazines and published in short story magazines and published in tiny presses all over the place. And that community of writers for those kind of publications, you know, a lot of us grew up with them. I mean, Daphne, same thing. It's and they kind of hold you together. And that small press culture, for me, was really, really important because there were years when kind of nobody knew about me, you know, but there were heroic editors like Peter at Iron Press.
My first story was in Iron.
Yeah, you know.
Peter's Iron. It was revelatory.
Absolutely.
To be published.
Yeah, just great. And so the moments of, you know, you just think, what the hell am I doing?
Mm.
We're balanced by the fact that, oh, you know, you're getting published in there, so on Sunk Island Review, which just comes down the road from here, or all these tiny magazines, which to me were, you know, great, great boon, great comfort.
Can I ask you to read a piece from your book? It's there.
Yeah.
Just one paragraph. This is from the story itself, Counting Stars.
Yeah. One glittering autumn night, I made a circle of my thumb and forefinger and peered through into the dozens and dozens of stars in that small space. I compared the smallness of this circle with the vastness all around and understood the huge potential of the night for blasphemy and death. My friends and I would tantalize and tempt ourselves when darkness ended our football games and we sprawled on the cold grass and our breath rose in plumes and vapor curled from the exposed skin of our hands and legs.
Thanks so much. I just think that's terrific writing, you know, and it's so evocative. But I was reading it, and I bought this as a book of children's short stories, and I read the line, you know, understood the huge potential of the night for blasphemy and death. And I wondered where the difference was in capturing childhood and then writing about childhood for children, and how you adjust writing.
Yeah, I mean, this Counting Stars is a really interesting case in point, because when I wrote Counting Stars, I wasn't thinking about children at all.
No.
You know, they were written for an adult audience, and they were published in things like London Magazine, Edinburgh Review. And then, you know, nobody publishes collections of short stories. Mm. And then when my first three novels came out with Hodder, and I talked about these stories at talks, and my editor said, oh, we want to publish these stories. Mm. And I said, but they were written for adults. She said, it doesn't matter. Mm. And so it was wonderful, you know, and it just showed that actually the difference between writing for adults and writing for children is very kind of fluid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's published by a children's publisher, and it's published by several children's publishers all around the world.
Right.
And I was pleased when it came out that, you know, it was reviewed in the Times alongside the new collection by William Trevor.
Right.
Which showed, again, you know, that the adult-children thing is really complicated and fluid, and I don't know what the answer
is. Do you also wish that it would have, like, that published in another crossover edition so it has the adult audience?
I do. And I want, you know, as I say, I'm still writing the stories. That story you have there, Slug's Dad, is from the sequence.
Yes.
And that came out as an adult short story and then was published as a children's publisher's fiction book, picture book. So,
do you write differently?
No,
consciously.
Absolutely no. Right. Absolutely not. There's only once that I found myself maybe kind of holding back, and it was with that book, Jackdaw Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing that; it was getting very dark and very violent, and I was aware it could actually have gone really kind of deep and gruesome, and I thought, oh no, just hold back.
It was an interesting book, Jackdaw Summer, because in other books I realised that the childhood, like sort of play or the fire eaters, that the world we're getting is really your childhood.
Hmm.
And in Jackdaw Summer, it's permeated by terrorism and war and threats.
Yeah.
We get shouts about Blair and Bush. But also you've lodged in that book this father who is this successful children's writer. And I wondered if actually bringing that father in freed that childhood for a youngster to inhabit, for it to become this sort of more contemporary childhood.
I think it did. I mean, it's set in the village that I live in now. It's set in my house, really.
Right.
So the father is probably a bit like me.
Yeah.
And yes, once it was like removing myself from it, I suppose. And, you know, people said it's a different book, and I thought, well, it's less kind of about memory.
Mm.
You know, it's not so much my memory. It's and also it's set, it doesn't seem very far, but it's set 30 miles away from Felling, which in Northumbrian terms is actually a massive distance. Northumbria is very different from Tyneside. And once I was in that kind of different kind of landscape, then yes. And also because Northumberland is a, you know, it's seen as very beautiful. It is very beautiful, and we talk about Northumbrian history. Northumbrian history was just absolutely bloody awful.
Mm.
You know, we talk about the Border Reavers, and there were a bunch of thugs and torturers. You know, they were just absolute monsters. And they were actually like the people in Liberia, you know, doing just terrible things in Liberia. So once I kind of removed my memory from it, it allowed that those kind of similarities to come out.
Mm. And often there's a young male central figure in the book who is fairly enraptured by a darker young male figure.
Mm.
But and there is such a sort of dark young male figure here in Jackdaw Summer, but Leon, the central character, is actually the dark figure. All of that, that mixture of dark and light is there in himself.
Yes.
And in fact, when there is eruption, you know, a violence, it comes from him mostly.
Yes. Yeah.
That seemed to be an evolution as well, getting people to see, well, it isn't actually displaced, it's there inside you.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that was influenced by, you know, by what's happened in the world in the last 10 years. In some ways, you know, I look over just my sort of publishing career of these books, and it's gone on 12 years. And when Skelly came out, it was kind of written into a time of sort of innocence, really, when I look back. And Scala came out in 98, you know, and in the early 2000s, some of the things that have happened in the world have just been just extraordinary. You know, who would have thought we'd be fighting hand to hand and, you know, slaughtering each other and beheading each other? And just
even in Tenerife.
Yes. Oh, no, yes. And it's just incredible what's happened. So, and again, I suppose it was like removing myself from it. It's not so much about memory. It's not so much about the past. And then writing during a time when just horrific things were happening and totally unexpected events occurred, that they came in and they became about the conflicts between, you know, good and evil within ourselves that are nothing to do with Catholicism, nothing to do with religion, but had to do with, you know, our natures. And you know, and some of the statements that, you know, people like George Bush would make, they just made you think, my God, you know, what do children make of people saying, we're going to bomb you, but it's okay, don't worry, you know, we won't really hurt you. And so it came from all of that, I guess.
The last strand of questions I've got is really about shamanism. And I never really expected to find shamanism in works, in any English works. And there I found it in yours. My own most shamanic book was one called I Was Carlos Castaneda. And that really surprised me in that it actually turned out to be about the principal character searching to go back into his own childhood to discover something that was sort of lost there and perverted since.
Yeah.
And then we find in Skellig this sort of fairly ancient, you know, angel figure at the beginning who sheds age and enters sort of youth and beauty. What for you is that process of reversing aging in the book?
It was really weird, you know, when you mentioned shamanism, because I didn't expect to find myself writing about that. But when I, through several books, I realised I was writing about that. And I was writing about, you know, people who kind of go into the darkness or find the darkness and they're almost destroyed and then they come back again.
Kids Wilderness was totally a shamanic
journey
into death, into the underworld.
Yes, and it almost like had nothing to do with me. You know, I didn't decide to do this. It was like, when I found myself writing for young people, it was like I just entered this sort of mythic zone where all this stuff was going on. And it was like you assemble the words and you put the pages together properly, and then, gosh, you know, they've gone down that mine. What they're doing down that mine, you know? Why are they finding stuff about the Ice Age? So a lot of the writing, and I think a lot of the writing was almost like being shamanistic myself. It was like being possessed, you know, which sounds mental. But actually, you know, I think when you're writing, well, it sometimes is like being... like driven by something else. And when I was writing Kit, you know, it really was like that. Oh, God, we're going into a mine. You know, what are we going to do? How are we going to get out again? But they go down, they get, you know, they go through lots of danger, get reassembled, and come back again.
And Mina's back down the mine now.
And Mina goes down the mine. And the new book is, in many ways, very shamanistic.
Is it really?
Yeah, and, you know, there's this thing about... the shamans that go out into the darkness and they get chopped up and really ruined, broken apart. And then they get reassembled again and come back into the world. I didn't know I was going to do that. You know, and it's like when people say, oh, you've got to plan your books, you know, prepare, plot your books. And I go, yeah, but it doesn't work like that. You know, you find yourself writing about things that somehow you have to write about.
Is there a certain freedom as well writing for a children's market because children don't have the barriers that say... well, that's nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the great excitements I felt when I started writing Skellig. I thought, you can't write that. Oh, I can, you know, because it's for kids.
Yeah, so just removing that inner sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. And kids will accept stories in all kinds of forms, you know, like Mina. You know, it's a kind of very, physically, visually, it's a very different form. And some adults will find that very difficult, but kids had no problem at all with it.
Yes.
And it's like with the picture books, you know, there's no area really in adult fiction where I could do a book like Slog's Dad with those illustrations. But with kids you can, because kids are used to dealing with all kinds of stories and all kinds of forms. And if you go into a children's book department, there's all kinds of stuff going on. And again, thinking about the small press, you know, the small presses that I was reading and loving and kind of aspiring to in the 70s were filled with totally balmy, bizarre stuff, you know, like concrete poetry and playing around with text and stuff, and I was starting to do that then. And it's only in the realm of children's fiction that I've been able to grow up and say, well, I'm doing that.
Right. Even Peter Mortimer's Iron really had these wild illustrations.
So it's the flexibility of kind of storytelling and writing for children has been a great... I've learned so much about how stories work through writing for kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, the next book that comes out is... it comes out in two editions, for adults and for children.
Right.
And to adults, I know that some adults it'll seem really weird, but I only learned how to do it by being a children's writer. Mm-hmm.
Mm. And by reading Marquez, maybe.
And by Borges. Yes, and by reading Marquez and Borges. And,
what about reading shamanism and shamanic literature? Does that fuel you at all? You mentioned this Native American, 19th century Native American.
Mm. Yeah, and Lobsang Rampa, yes. You know, who I read when I was 13, and Lobsang, does anybody know Lobsang Rampa?
Yeah.
Yes. Just, and I read it when I was about 13, he kind of, you know, really, it's an extraordinary book, I think, for a 13-year-old.
Yes.
I loved it, and that changed me, and because I was a Catholic, I was driven to read about religion, but you know, if you're a Catholic, all you can read is the Catechism. Mm. And then the books that are on the index, or not on the index. Mm. And so I just explored all kinds of stuff, you know. So I was reading all kinds of stuff about astral projection and ghosts and spirits and shamans. And all through my teenage years, as well as reading, you know, Marquez and whoever and Hemingway. So that all those things went together for me. And I remember when I was in America, and I was in somewhere in the Northwest, and I got a book that was actually about shamanism and about mainly about Siberian and Native American people, and that was a big influence on me.
Mm-hmm.
But that was only about 7 years ago, so I learned a lot from reading that.
You say back in Felling, when you were looking back, you suddenly realised, well, I grew up with angels and,
yeah,
and ghosts.
That's right.
But they were literally there.
They were there, and like the tramp was there, you know, and the same, when I look back at them, these people seemed really exotic and weird and just filled with, you know, just this amazing kind of imagery. And and it was just, you know, I remember writing counts, and it just seemed fantastic. And suddenly Dragonis became a kind of, Dragonis was just a place where people went and sat with their hats and drank Horlicks, you know, had ice cream. But fictionally, imaginatively, it became like an important kind of literary cafe. And it was just Dragonis and Felon.
Yeah. I like as well that you almost seem to be bringing Felon back into prominence. It's no longer a suburb of Gateshead. It's its own world.
Yeah, and people wouldn't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, I looked it up. I thought, does it exist? Did you invent this? Is this Wikipedia entry for Felling a spoof? So we have some people that think dearly of your work, and do we have any questions?
Well, I'm very interested in what you were saying about the crossover between adults and children's literature and the fact that there isn't a marked difference. I teach children's literature here, and one of the things we often discuss is whether, are there any no-go areas for children's writing, or can a children's writer really write about anything?
I think you can write about anything, and but I think, as I was saying, when I was writing Jackdaw Summer, I was aware of, and I wasn't kind of doing it consciously, I found myself doing it, I'm stopping that. You know, there's a boy, Natras, in it, that he's a nasty bit of work, and he says, you know, a statement which I'm going to do more, that he said, I can imagine anything.
Mm-hmm.
And when I wrote that, I thought, God, you know, he can. And there's nothing amazing about being able to imagine anything. You know, it's like when we read about what torturers do. Torturers can imagine absolutely anything. And I wrote that not long after reading American Psycho, you know, Bret Easton Ellis. And I remember reading reviews saying what an extraordinary imagination he had to be able to imagine all these gruesome things that people could do to each other. I thought, well, it's actually not that, it's not that imaginative, you know. Go to any torture chamber and they're imagining the same. So when I was doing Jackdaw Summer, I thought I could just go really, really far with this, but I held back. But I think you can kind of... I think because most of my books are written from the point of view of a child, a young person, that in itself imposes the limitations of what you can do. So in a sense, there's no area that you can go to, but there are points that you can't go beyond. I'm not quite sure how they are. But like the new book, as I say, is coming out in adult and children's editions. I've got two covers. It's called The True Tale of the Monster Billy Jean. It's exactly the same book with two different jackets.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So
I'm not sure which is which.
No.
Yes,
no. Nobody can tell, and that's, no. You know, and again, that's another thing. It's like, you know, so. But I suppose it's an adult book because it's a bit darker, it goes a bit further. It's also kind of complicated linguistically. But, you know, I do think that, you know, I've worked a couple of times with a fantastic illustrator called Polly Dunbar. And she said, when I first started working with her, she's a fantastic illustrator. She said, you know, the younger I get, the more profound I get. And so it's almost like, and I think some of my work for very young children, like My Dad's a Birdman or The Boy Who Climbed Into the Moon, are actually in some ways much better than the older stuff. In some ways, I'm not quite sure why.
Could you say something about why you might think of
it? I think it's because you can't write long, you have to strip away lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. So you get down to some kind of essential poetry, I think. Mm-hmm. Again, the children are, you know, able to deal with, and, you know, kind of poetic rhythms. And this kind of space around the words, mm-hmm. for the imagination. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something to do with that, you know, something to do with the stripping things down. You know, as a writer, I just like to cut away anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm quite a succinct writer. And then writing for 8-year-olds, you just have to go, you know, right. Throw away all the clutter. And say, look, this is what it is.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then you can also go beyond normal bounds as well and enter the moons. And
yes.
Is that also because those children haven't set the barriers in place so that you can actually have a boy climb a ladder to a moon to meet a girl and disappear from the adult world for a while?
Yes. Yeah, I think so, because, you know, children know that they don't know everything yet, so they're not blocked. And also it's the same with form, you know, it's like... I write plays as well, you know, and when I first started writing plays, I was aware of... some playwright friend saying, who the hell does he think he is? You know, in plays now. But I learned how to do that from children. You know, kids, if you tell a kid a story, they'll start to act it out, don't they? Mm. They'll start to dance it, they'll start to sing it, they'll start to act it out. I thought, well, if they can do that, I can do that as well. So the fluidity of form is a fantastic thing with kids. Yeah.
That's good. Stephen.
Hi. I first read Slog's Dad about 4 years ago, so it made a really big impression on me, and to the extent that I've just finished the story, which I kind of, you know, draws on a lot of the, you know, the mythology, because it's to do with my own sort of Catholic upbringing.
All right,
and but an interesting, you know, what I like about Slog's Dad so much is that it seems to take the religious stories, you know, the belief in heaven and all that kind of thing, and through the kids reclaim it for the, you know, for their own ends, you know, for their own, you know, the healing kind of.
Yeah.
Ends. Is that a fair reading of it? Were you trying to reclaim, you know, some of these mythologies and dogmas and make them more human?
I think so. And when I was writing Slog's Dad, I wrote it really quickly. It was a really fast story to write, and it just felt, in a sense, felt very ordinary. I felt like I was at a point where the kids would just take, you know, things that were seen as, you know, about kind of standard religion, about Catholicism, and just kind of adopt it for their own lives and for their own needs and for their own imaginings, you know. And it seems the imagination is a, you know, an extraordinary thing, and, you know, we can do all kinds of things. And, so, yeah, I suppose it is doing that. It was a remarkable story, Slog's Dad. You know, I wrote really fast to a commission, and it was from a fragment of Carver's notebooks, Raymond Carver, and we were given commissions that took fragments of Carver's and Chekhov's notebooks, and they just had little phrases that, and they said, which phrase do you want to take? And I took a phrase from Carver's notebook, and it was, how much longer have I got? And I think Carver was sort of talking about himself as he was getting towards the end of his life. But as a Catholic boy, how much longer have I got? I thought, well, it's like, how much longer have I got on the earth before I go back to heaven? Mm-hmm. So it's got Catholic roots, but it was like, it's very physical and worldly, isn't it? It's about...
Well, there's a sort of sense when you brought up a Catholic that you've sort of been made to think about heaven and death at a very early age, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah. And I remember that, you know, I remember the torments of being five, Catholic five-year-old. God, it's terrifying, isn't it? Lying in bed, you know, and dreaming about going to hell. And here I am, you know, 50 years later, and I'm thinking, oh, God, I've got to get that out. Let's write Slugs Down.
Catherine.
It was, always the kind of dominant thing when I write is the local, is the kind of physicality of it. So when I was writing Skellig, for instance, you know, Skellig is discovered after Michael's journey through the garage. And as I was writing, I never knew what was going to happen in Skellig. And when Michael goes through the garage, I didn't have a clue what he was going to find or if he would find anything. But what I was aware of when I was writing that, he's just walking through the garage, he's only moving from here to there, that it's filled with sounds and senses and things that he touches and things that he hears. And I was really aware when I was doing that of establishing the physicality of the place. And I think that was something I learned from doing Counting Stars. It was like, you can't do anything, or I don't feel I can do anything until, you know, there's a solid world, there's a real world. And because the world that I'd started to write about was Felling and Tyneside and Newcastle, and I mean, Skellig is set in the house that I used to live in. You know, it's exactly that house with the toilet and the dining room. All the stuff in Skellig was like the house. And the garage is like the garage that we had. So taking real places, and then that, to me, is the important thing. And the remarkable thing when I began to write Counting Stars was the thing about suddenly, you know, I'd been trying to get into London Magazine, for instance, for years and years, and no. You know, and then I sent them a story from Counting Stars, Lucy Fine. Yes, you know, let's have this. And then the same with Edinburgh Review and other magazines. And they were all apparently about insignificant people in insignificant places. And I sort of experienced that thing about, you know, the real insignificant local world is where universal experience occurs. And then I found it particularly in Skellig. And after that, it's like you don't... It's almost like you don't have to go hunting for it, you know. If you work closely enough with attention to detail, if there's anything universal, it'll come out. It'll appear. You don't have to kind of hammer it in. Mm.
Do you think there's a difference thinking about the local? I don't know. Say somebody writing about the southeast as the local.
It would be, but it would
as contrasted with the northeast as the local in relation to the universal.
It would, of course, it would be very different because it would be their place. And, you know, the Counting Stars, the long-term kind of project that Counting Stars is part of is Stories from the Middle of the World. In the middle of the world is 7 Caldwell Park Avenue, Felling-on-Tyne. It's actually the kitchen in 7 Caldwell Park. It's actually a chair in the kitchen. That's the middle of the world. But for somebody from the southeast, theirs would be a totally different place, but just as filled with, you know, the universal. Yeah. It's like, you know, when we're kids, you know, you do that, don't you? Say, you know, David Armand, Tooth Urmia, Felling, Gateshead, County Durham, England, you know, Europe, the world, the galaxy, the universe. Yeah.
Do you think if you haven't left Tyneside, you wouldn't have had the same appreciation? Going away was that big part of it?
I don't know, really. I do often find it amazing that I'm still there. You know, I don't live there. I'm sort of in rural Northumberland now, but I still find it amazing that I'm still there. And I'm, you know, I have this kind of love-hate relationship with it. Of course, I love it. You know, it's in my bones and blood. But also, I kind of hate it a lot of the time. I want to go and live in Colombia and be Marquez, but I'm not. You know,
I'm glad to be here and be Marquez. Yeah. I was really surprised when the characters in Counting Stars suddenly were living in a flat which I put into a city. There's a, and you actually have mythical parts of the city as well here, down by the river. And
yes, yeah.
That becomes mythical as well. And, Mary. And then.
I just want to talk about the life of the writer, because these days a writer is under a lot of pressure to appear in public, sort of at festivals or book signings or a gathering like this. I'm just wondering how you see that. You know, is it seen as a pressure, or do you see it as an opportunity, or is it at odds a little bit with you as the writer who that's at your desk in your kitchen?
It's very nice to get out. You know, I mean, I love writing, you know, and writing is, that's what I do. And occasionally it can, if you find yourself doing too much, I mean, I get asked to do loads of things it can be exhausting, actually. And one of the main things that's really hard is the kind of how you become public, you know, how you become. Being a writer is a very private occupation. And I remember when Skellig took off, and, you know, I was a part-time special needs teacher in Tyneside and just, you know, a writer. And I went to some events, and people were just coming at me and saying, oh, you're David Harmon, aren't you? You were at Skellig, didn't you? And I came out of the building, and across the street there was a big photograph of me with a big photograph of Skellig. And it was suddenly, and it was very weird. And so that can be very kind of oppressive. So you have to find ways to deal with it. I mean, fortunately, I was in my 40s by then. I think it must be really hard when it happens in your 20s, how people cope with it. And then the demands to travel and to do stuff. As long as you keep it under control, it's great, actually. It's really nice. And people are lovely, you know. You go to places and people are really pleased to see you, which is very nice.
Funny.
Poetry, that you, and it, I mean, struck me reading your work that it's you managed to say a great deal using very few words, actually. I was interested in the sense of the relationship with the child reading, because it leaves a lot of room for children to make their own meaning and interpret what's happening in the text. Is that a conscious decision? Perhaps, you know, perhaps after what you've been saying about being told very much this is true and this is right and this is. With your sort of Catholic upbringing, is there a conscious decision to allow that openness, to allow them to find their own way through the text?
I think in a sense you can't choose how you're going to write. You can't choose your style. You know, your style just is you, and you find, when you find it, you think, oh, you know, you suddenly find you're writing in a way that's you too. So I think that kind of openness I've been kind of trying to develop anyway, or heading towards it through short story writing, because for about 12 years I wrote an output short stories, and that's what I wanted to do. And, you know, concision and suggestion and leaving space for, you know, the reader to imagine stuff. And, you know, the short story writers, all of them were people like, Carver, you know, Raymond Carver was a great revelation to me, because, you know, there's kind of nothing there, but there's so much there. And I think in many ways I'm still a short story writer. And when I wrote Skellig, I found a way to write something that looked like a novel, it actually isn't. It's kind of a series of scenes. It's a series of scenes, and all my novels are like that. The series of little fragments, because I thought I'd never be able to write a novel because it just looked too long. And I think maybe that was another reason I became a children's writer, because you can actually write quite short and be concise, and kids don't find that too challenging. And now I've written, you know, quite a long novel for me. But I've learned how to do that through writing for kids. The first novel I wrote about 15 years ago, before I wrote Skellig, and it was rejected by every publisher in Great Britain. And it was quite long, and it was quite a 90,000-word novel, I think. Very baggy, and I did it because I felt a duty to write a novel. So it wasn't a deliberate decision, but it seemed that it made me feel at home being a children's writer.
I entered Counting Stars thinking I was reading a book of short stories, but I read it as a novel. And it has that build in it. For me, it has that arc and development. Valerie.
Your got a lot about education in Skelly. Mm. You've got the homeschool child, Mingo, and you've got Michael going to school, and he goes in and out of school a few times. There seems to be quite a lot of passion behind that, and I wondered whether you do have quite strong views about the way children are educated, either now or when you were a child.
Yeah. I mean, I hated school. When I was secondary school, I hated it, and I mean, I was very kind of uncomfortable in school. Primary school was fine, but then I went to Catholic grammar school, and we were treated with contempt a lot of the time, you know, and the teachers a lot of the time were just seemed to be very conceited. And so I kind of got through the education system, then went to university, and then I thought, what am I going to do? I want to be a writer. I'll be a teacher, because you get long holidays. And then, of course, I was so knackered I didn't write anything, but also became really interested in teaching, and to my amazement, really enjoyed it, and it really made me think about lots of things. So I was writing all through the years I was teaching, so I was in and out of teaching and doing different kind of teaching. And then when I was training to be a teacher in the late 70s, there was a lot of discussion about things like de-schooling society and you know, radical approaches to education, alternative and sceptical views of education. But then a lot of the young teachers I met towards the end of my teaching had never heard of things like this. And, you know, and some of the great statement, I woke up one day, and because, you know, put Today on, and David Blunkett was on, and he was saying, any child who is not in a classroom is a child not learning. And I thought, you know, what a mad statement, you know. We've got an education secretary who thinks it's all right to say something like that. And that was around...
Was that before you wrote Mina?
Oh, it was before I wrote Mina.
Right.
But it was just, I think, probably just the time I was writing Skellig. And then when I was writing Skellig, Mina came in, you know, and said, how can a bird that is born for joy sit in a cage and sing? So she's just expressing the sceptical view of education. I mean, I'm not as radical as Mina is. Of course I'm not. I was a teacher. And I, you know, I think schools now are, God, they're streets ahead of the schools I went to. I think teachers are much better. I think kids are much more learned and intelligent and emotionally competent than we were. Politicians are the problem, you know, and views of education that are very mechanistic. So Mina was expressing a kind of point of view which seems to me has to be stated, that, you know, we have to keep reminding ourselves that actually kids are learning when they're not in schools. Schools are not the only way to teach things. Absolutely, and that's, you know, and that definitely, towards the end of my teaching, see, I am passionate, it was getting mad, you know. Before you taught anything, you had to say exactly what the child was going to learn from it, and the child had to say that as well, and when you'd done it, you had to say exactly what you'd learned, and it just seemed mental, you know. It was like...
Back to the catechism,
and it's just wrong, isn't it? That's not how we learn, and we don't know what we're going to learn, and even when we've learned it, we don't know that we've learned it. It's like with writing, you know, anybody who writes knows that you don't know a lot of the time what you're writing about. And then somebody will come to you and say what you're writing. Somebody will tell you what you've been writing about, and you think, oh, yeah, I didn't know that. But all that, yeah, all that outcomes-driven stuff, I think, is absolutely stupid. Absolutely stupid. And it's designed for politicians because they can seem tough when they say, you know, we're going to have these outcomes, we're going to drive up standards. I mean, I do think kids transcend all this. I mean, I've got a 13-year-old daughter, and she and her friends just seem to me to be extraordinary. You know, the young generation, I think, are just amazing. So there's something going right in education, but it's not the politicians who are doing it.
Any other questions? Can I ask what it's like to suddenly find you've written a classic, and that children everywhere have read, and it's become part of their fabric? Does it change your nature of Skellig? Do you keep learning more about it?
Well, I keep learning things about Skellig, yeah, definitely. Because, as I said, you know, you don't know what you've written even when you've written it. And certainly, I've learned a lot about Skellig through the adaptations, you know, because it's been on stage, it's been on film, it's been in opera. Mm. And each time there's a new adaptation, and each time it's staged again, I learn something new about the story and something about this. And when I was writing Skellig, I didn't know what was going on. It really did seem to come through me. It just seemed to appear on the page in front of me. And so when I was writing it, I was aware that there was something going on. And I knew it was good. And I knew it was... I knew nothing about children's fiction, but I knew this book had something in it. And each time I look at it for adaptation, it seems to me an amazing thing.
You didn't object to the infernal liberties of the film.
No, I think the film, you should have seen what at one point what they wanted to do.
Oh, really?
So in the end, it's all right.
Yeah, okay.
But I, you know, people write books about Skellig, and they write to me and say, you know, Diana Strom, that was really clever the way you made that thing on page 17 match up so perfectly with that page on 96. Mm. It was, wasn't it?
Yes.
You can't do these things consciously.
No. Really. Any other? I'll let you say. Oh, is there a question? Oh, yes, Sonia.
I was just going to ask, you mentioned earlier you're sometimes dealing with very bleak material in some of your books. But there does seem to be a core of a sense of redemption and beauty in the text. Is that something you feel very strongly is central to the text?
I do. I think that sense of beauty is something that is more and more important to me. And almost like the older I get, you know, the older I get, the more astonished I am by this world that we live in. And that, you know, of course, there are bleak things happening. Some human actions are just, you know, just terrible. But and the new book is filled with, you know, the kind of dreadful effects of human actions. But I think it really is a book about discovering something beautiful. And one of my editors asked me recently, she was talking to me, we were talking together about what I might do next, and she was saying, well, and all that Catholic stuff is kind of going now, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it is going, it's still there, but I said, kind of what's replacing it is a sense of beauty. You know, Ann Patchett, the American writer, she wrote a book called Run, and I read the book called Run a couple of years ago. It was given to me by a friend. She said, read that. And in the middle of it, there's a priest who's dying, and he's reflecting on his life, and he said, I've spent all my life preparing for the afterlife, preparing for where I'm going to. He said, I've just been wrong. He said, this has been the afterlife. This has been heaven. And he said, the reason that people die is that so that other people can come along to see the view. Mm. And that just seemed to me just an amazing thing. You know, why would we die? To make space for somebody else to come along and just look and say, look at this. So I think my books are more and more about that. And I think that book is about that. You know, just the beauty of this place. Mm.
I was struck as well. Here's another line from you. This is from The Time Machine. She wears high heels, short skirt. Makeup is caked on her face. Her eyes are rimmed by black mascara. I start to turn away, then catch my breath at the tenderness I see in her.
Hmm.
And that seems to be part of your writing as well, helping us to see beauty where we would normally dismiss the opportunity of it all.
I think so.
And tenderness as well, finding tenderness in places.
That was really important to me when I began to write. And when I became aware of writing about Tyneside and about the people that I knew, and a lot of the people that I knew, like particularly some of my uncles that I'm thinking about, they would have been dismissed by the common culture as just being tough, rough, you know, empty, thick men. But as a child, you knew how tender they were, and you knew how, you know, they had really kind of profound feelings. So that was really important to me to express the tenderness beneath things that appear to be very rough, which is like Tyneside itself. You know, Tyneside, you know, especially in the 50s, was quite a rough, tough, physically unattractive place. Mm. But you do just go slightly below the surface. It's just, you know, gorgeous and tender and lovely.
Well, thanks for taking us below the surface. That'd be great. Thank you, David.
Thanks very much.